So this is a kind of an odd topic tonight. I'm going to talk a little about the divisions, political divisions in our country, which is kind of an odd Dharma talk. Of course, yesterday was the 245th birthday of the United States, theoretically. Last week, I talked a little about some of the symbolism around the founding of the country. And this is a little more present moment stuff. And kind of as a preamble to talk about anything political, I'm going to talk a little about toxic shame. Toxic shame is a feeling that probably all of us have to some extent. It is the worst feeling. It is a kind of internal hell to be in touch with it, and it is a feeling of, you know, I am not worthy at all. I don't belong here. I'm lower than, you know, I'm the lowest thing in existence. You know, all that. And when people act from toxic shame, there's all kinds of ways that it can play out in, you know, topping behavior, competitiveness. You know, insofar as I can top somebody else, it's a momentary release, at least at that moment. I'm not the lowest thing in the whole universe because they're lower than me, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, fixation on being right, you know, again, right as a being right and proving someone else wrong is a kind of topping. And it's also kind of the nature of toxic shame that if I act out my toxic shame in some unhealthy way towards someone else, it often stimulates toxic shame in others. And then that person might react from a place of, you know, well, I'm going to top you. Well, I'm going to top you, you know, and that sort of thing, you know. So an important thing just to monitor. Well, what are some of the things that we can be right and wrong about, and passionately right and wrong about? Well, certainly among them is morality. And it's interesting, the people who study morality, who have studied it worldwide, they found that if you look at moral rules throughout the world, across all cultures, they fall into five basic categories. And so those categories are caring and not harming, you know, being good to people, not causing harm, fairness, respect for authority, purity, and in-group loyalty. And what's fascinating about this moment in our political situation is that liberals, you know, everyone's a little bit different, but typically liberals are at 100% on the first two, and basically at 0% on the other three, you know. So we're liberals are all about, you know, compassion and being compassionate to everyone and not causing harm and fairness. And it's so important that the world be fair, this sort of thing. But then there's lots of voices in the liberal community that are, you know, that reject any sort of respect for authority, reject, you know, traditional purity standards and, you know, in-group loyalty is just tribalism, you know, this sort of thing. Conservatives tend to be more at 50 or 60% across all five. And so right away you get these archetypal kinds of things where liberals are saying, you're not compassionate enough, you're not fair enough. And, you know, conservatives are saying, well, you know, you don't respect authority enough and you're not pure enough and you're not respecting your own kind enough, you know. And so there's this mismatch. And I'd say, you know, and I'll say that, you know, giving this talk, I'm a liberal myself. I'll just out myself, and I assume that in talking to people who come to a meditation center in Berkeley, that I might be talking to mostly liberals. So I'm going to be focusing a little more on that side. You know, it's a wonderful spiritual question for us to work with. You know, what is our attitude toward authority? What is our attitude toward purity? What is our attitude toward in-group loyalty? And it doesn't mean that we necessarily have to embrace the values as the conservatives would, you know, promulgate them. But I think it changes the nature of the conversation if liberals are also giving some kind of credence to those three dimensions. You know, what are the kinds of authority that we do value? You know, what are the kinds of purity that we are willing to embody or strive for? And what are the ways that in-group loyalty in certain situations is something very helpful and beneficial? You know, it's... you know, because there are many expressions of liberalism in this country where those three dimensions are just completely rejected and almost flamboyantly rejected, you know.
Is it okay to ask a clarifying question?
Please.
For the in-group loyalty, I always associate that with kind of identity politics, which I associated with liberals. Conservatives, on the other side, look at people as individuals, not as part of a group.
Yeah, I'd say it comes more in, you know, for example, if you look at the, you know, the very stereotypical responses to immigration, you know, and whereas liberals are saying, you know, we need to be compassionate to these people, we need to give them a fair chance, and conservatives are saying, well, it's more important to take care of our own kind, the Americans, you know, the people born here, rather than let others in, you know. And, yeah, I'll go back to that, but... yeah, so it certainly is, the kind of flamboyant rejection of some of those more conservative ideals. How can I say? Anytime we're rejecting anything powerfully, we're rejecting part of ourselves, you know? And it's... you know, to get to if I'm rejecting part of myself, then that is somebody else getting hit with that kind of, you know, that the outward expression of that. That's going to be a painful thing. And again, it's going to be triggering to, you know, any part of them that they might reject. And so it's certainly something to look at. Another aspect in... on the liberal side that I think is worth looking at is, how can I say, the culture of offense and the whole idea of taking offense. Offense, taking offense, is really, in a technical sense, it is an infantile state. And what I mean by that, when we're infants... basically, the state we have when we're infants in the crib is, you know, I throw a temper tantrum, I scream, and other people come and satisfy my needs. You know, so it's a pretty good deal, you know. And there's ways that grown-ups still want to sort of almost hang on to that deal in one way or another. You know, some kind of drama, you know, I'll do some sort of drama in my life and expect other people to satisfy my needs, you know, like the person who's chronically disappointed and, you know, pulls out the I'm disappointed in you, you know, and then the people pleasers, you know, try to satisfy their needs. So when I take offense, that's a tremendously dramatic position. In other words, nobody really takes offense and keeps it to themselves. You know, it's very much a position of drama where they announce, you know, you've offended me, or that person has offended me. And not a whole lot of action happens in that place. It's actually a very powerless place. You know, I may, you know, make a lot of noise and drama with, you know, commiserating with someone else. Can you believe what that person said? You know, like that sort of thing. But no action actually comes from that place. And in many ways, it is a giving away of power. You know, when I say, you know, that person has offended me, In a way, I'm saying that person has agency over my internal states. And it's so funny because I think there's so many ways that, you know, we've gotten to a point where being offended is almost a badge of honor, you know, and especially, say, among white people, like the more offended I can be on a matter of race, you know, that means that I'm more woke or something like this, you know. I think it's very important to realize that when we think of the people who really are the icons in accomplishing so much for social justice, whether it's Dr. King or Malcolm X or Cesar Chavez, Nelson Mandela, none of these are people who spent a lot of time in, you know, I'm offended. You know, they were acting from authentic emotions, so authentic anger, authentic sadness. You know, acting from authentic emotions can be very powerful and can be inspiring to others. Whereas offense is a powerless place. And it's funny because there is, I think, a dynamic among pundits on the right who take a certain joy in offending liberals. And even, you know, it's a joke, you know, liberals are easy to offend, you know, this sort of thing. And I think it's almost this deep knowing that as long as they can offend the liberals are going to be powerless and not get anything done, you know. And so it's very interesting to look at, you know, it's always important to look at all the ways that we give our power away. Connected to the culture of offense, and really you might say a culmination of it, is the cancel culture, you know, which we've seen a little bit of. And it's a very sad group behavior that we're seeing now. Again, part of the dynamic of toxic shame, to go back to that, is it's such a painful place in me that many people, they don't want to feel it at all. They push it away. I don't want anything to do with that, you know, that kind of thing. And it's the fantasy that if I can project that outward, oh, it's that person who's the problem. I'm going to shut them out. I'm going to shut them up. You know, I never have to deal with them again. It's almost this fantasy that the pain that actually resides in my body, I can farm off to somebody else and shut them out and not have to deal with it anymore, you know? And that power, again, that powerful rejecting on the outside always mirrors a very powerful rejecting on the inside. And so what would be the antidote or the way to move forward from all of this? The way I like to say it is, I like to frame it as a love that crosses all boundaries of otherness. And saying that, I realize that I'm being kind of a typical liberal and valorizing the first of the five axes. As I said last week when I was talking about this a little bit, I see some of this, that ideal of love, the love that crosses all boundaries of otherness or breaks down boundaries of otherness in the motto E Pluribus Unum. And I do think of it also as one of the defining marks of the Christian Gospels, you know, that this character of Jesus walked around not only saying, but also performing in all ways this love across boundaries of otherness, all the rejects of society, gathering together, feasting with them, you know, so much so that he was criticized by the religious elite of his time. And the value of this love across boundaries of otherness is that, first of all, it can be magic in the interpersonal world, but it's also magic in the intrapersonal world, in all the places that I've othered by rejecting them, you know, and really the journey toward embodying a love across boundaries of otherness, it's simultaneously an opening outward as well as an opening inward, and those two mirror each other very much, you know, the more you know, anything that I can't accept out there corresponds to something I can't accept in here, you know. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. I always have a quote sheet. A few from Eastern scriptures. Lao Tzu says, "Conquering the world and changing it, I do not think that this can succeed. The world is a sacred vessel that cannot be changed. He who changes it will destroy it. He who seizes it will lose it." From the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is one of the foundational Buddhist scriptures. The Buddhist scriptures, it's funny, you know, if you look at the Triptika, the full Buddhist canon, it takes up a whole bookshelf. Oh. Zoom ended the meeting. Okay. All right, well, I'm not sure what that was about, but... All right. But scholars actually feel that the Dhammapada is represents sayings of the historical Buddha himself. And so the Dhammapada in many ways has a similar historical role to, say, the Sermon on the Mount in the Christian Gospels. And so from the Dhammapada, "Make your mind pure as a silversmith blows away the impurities of silver, little by little, instant by instant." Kind of one of those statements of purity that you know, perhaps liberals could get behind. From the Upada Sutta, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, This is half the holy life, Lord, admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." "Don't say that, Ananda," said the Buddha. "Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as his friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." And so this tremendous importance on the Sangha. This wonderful one, I love this one from Zhuangzi. He's one of the later Taoist writers. "Right is not right, so is not so. If right were really right, it would differ so clearly from not right that there would be no need for argument. If so were really so, it would differ so clearly from not so that there would be no need for argument." There's an African proverb, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others." Plato tells us the wisest have the most authority. So that's one way to look at authority. The third Zen patriarch, Sangsen, said, "When the mind exists undisturbed in the Tao, nothing in the world can offend. And when a thing can no longer offend, it ceases to exist in the old way." Kierkegaard said, "Purity of heart is will to one thing." Nietzsche said, "One must be a sea to receive a polluted stream without becoming impure." Gandhi said, "Moral authority is never retained by any attempt to hold it. It comes without seeking and is retained without effort." It's so true, because the point when someone's saying, "Well, I'm a moral authority," that's kind of when they lose it all. I just had to throw this one in by Marx. "Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies." The Dalai Lama said, "The ultimate authority always must rest with the individual's own reason and critical analysis." Thich Nhat Hanh said, "The Sangha is a community of friends practicing Dharma together in order to bring about and to maintain awareness. The essence of this Sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. When you do not see these in a community, it is not the true Sangha, and you should have the courage to say so. But when you find these elements are present in community, you know that you have the happiness and fortune of being in a real Sangha. Bruce Lee, who was a rather extraordinary individual, said, "Be like water making its way through the cracks. Do not be assertive, but adjust to the object, and you shall find a way around it or through it. If nothing within you stays rigid, outward things will disclose themselves." Jack Kornfield, actually very similar to one that we saw earlier, similar to the Nietzsche quote, "If you put a spoonful of salt in a cup of water, it tastes very salty. If you put a spoonful of salt in a lake of fresh water, the taste is still pure and clear. Peace comes when our hearts are open like the sky, vast as the ocean." Sharon Salzberg said, "We need to redefine community and find a variety of ways of coming together and helping each other." Steven Pinker said, "If you aren't just brought up in your tribe but interact with other people either directly or vicariously through journalism or literature, you see what life is like from other points of view and are less likely to demonize them or dehumanize them and more likely to empathize with them." Chris Yami said, "There are those who are so easily offended that they lose their ability to ever discern any truth. And this is often derived from a sort of frenzy by way of their own mass projection, their own mass prejudice." Shannon Alder says, "The only real conflict you will ever have in life won't be with others, but with yourself." Mokokama, I'm not sure how to say his last name, "Freedom of speech gives us the right to offend others, whereas freedom of thought gives them the choice as to whether or not to be offended." Robert Selner says quite bluntly, "The more easily you are offended, the less developed you are as a human being." I can imagine people being offended by that. Dan Mager says, "Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Which is more important? Which is healthier? Which brings you closer to the love and to those you love and care about? What moves you to the person you are meant to be, your true self? Looking at these two options through this lens can make the choice very simple." And finally, Hannah Sohel says, "See the world through the eyes of your inner child, the eyes that sparkle in awe and amazement as they see love and magic and mystery in the most ordinary things."